notice, this are the bunch of caveats or things at the beginning. The goal today is to discuss orthodoxy and non-orthodoxy. My role in that is kind of discuss non-orthodox Judaism. Not necessarily all people, because as we know, based on the last Pew study in America at least, well, let me give a piece of the pie, especially people from outside the United States. I had a friend from Australia years ago who once remarked that she thought there were two types of Jews in the world. There were Israelis, there were diaspora Jews, and Americans. The reality is that there are about, depending on whose study you follow, there are about 14 million Jews in the world today. Of those, around 6 million are in Israel, just under 6 million are in the United States. That puts 2 million throughout the rest of the world. So the Israeli situation and the American situation obviously dominate. The other country not represented here is France. France has about 500,000 Jews. So once you take that out, it's about 1.5 million Jews and the rest of the countries all combined, if that many. It really depends on how you count. So a lot of what we're going to talk about today is going to deal with the second largest Jewish community in the world, which is going to be a lot of America, but we're going to talk about Europe also. Caveat number two is what I'm discussing here will deal with Sephardim, but by and large, the experience of the Sephardic communities and the European communities were very different. The Sephardic communities did not go through the European Reformation. They did not go through the European struggle of emancipation, and they didn't go through all the other issues that cropped up with modern European nationalism, et cetera, et cetera. So the experience of Jews from Eidot HaMizrach is very different than those of Europe. Not true about Spanish Jews, right? Real, the Sephardim of the original name. In fact, Eidot HaMizrach is a much better name for those Jews from Eastern countries, as opposed to the Spaniards did to some degree, but as we know, they were kicked out in 1492, and now they're being invited back, right? Anyone here a Spanish background, you can become a citizen of Spain, you just got to learn Spanish. Yeah, you got Spanish, you can become a citizen of Spain. How good is your Spanish?
Not really.
You have to take a test in Spanish. Supposedly Portugal is going to allow Jews to come back without being able to speak Portuguese, but the Spanish require you to take a Spanish exam in order to become a Spaniard again. I don't think they're going to require you to speak like medieval Catalonian, which would be more accurate. You know, the Rambam would have never spoken, or the Barbanel, to think someone who was actually kicked out probably never spoke modern, wouldn't understand modern Spanish necessarily exactly, but whatever. The other issue is that according to the Pew study in the United States of America, the fastest growing group of Jews are those who do not affiliate whatsoever. They now cover around 35%, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have Pew in front of me, but around 35%. The Pew study was this massive survey that was done just under 10 years ago. The reason that there were surveys of Jews in America, like there are surveys of Jews in Israel, probably surveys of Jews in other countries as well. We know, for instance, in England, you can probably get a packet. You're going to need a packet. In England, they lied for years and years about the number of Jews in England. They exaggerated the numbers by 100,000, claiming that they were closer to 375,000 Jews. And then Lord Sachs, at some point near the end of his career, admitted that they were over-exaggerating by 100,000 people. In British Jewry is around 275,000 Jews. So that's like a large city in the United States. So the United States was done with large swaths, but we're going to go back to the United States only had 14,000 Jews, just like that, and early on. Okay, you guys are all with me? Fine. Last time that I spoke in this particular forum, I discussed the creation of quote-unquote modern Orthodox Judaism. Probably was like a dumb way to do it. We probably should have started out talking about non-Orthodoxy as opposed to starting out with modern Orthodoxy. Because orthodoxy, per se, a minor orthodoxy of its particular persuasion, is more or less a reaction to reform. If we go back in the history of medieval Jewry, we know that Jews, certainly post-expulsion from Spain, were ghettoized throughout Europe, were really treated as the other, until Napoleon came along and the French Revolution,
and they started to say, well, maybe Jews are human beings. But for a good chunk of the late Middle Ages, you couldn't, Middle Ages, I'm going to describe them as Jewish Middle Ages until Napoleon, you really couldn't be part, you couldn't get like, share with, their, like everyone, I told everyone I have 2-to-1. You couldn't be part of, you were either part of the Jewish community or you're part of the Christian community in Europe. You couldn't be something in the middle. There wasn't such a thing as secular Judaism. It doesn't mean, this is an important point, I think, it doesn't mean that we have any idea what people really believed. You never know what people really believe. You know what people write about. You know what people, what their public experiences are. But you don't really know what in the heart of hearts people are thinking. It's just, you can't do that. It's an impossibility. Once upon a time, people thought you could, but you really can't. We talked last time about the kind of the struggles of emancipation. We talked about Moses Mendelssohn, who was the first Jew who was allowed to live in Berlin. We talked about last time. Moses Mendelssohn kind of sparked this idea in Germany that maybe you could be a German in the street and a Jew at home, creating this idea that maybe Jews really could become citizens of their countries like France, which they were almost immediately in the 1790s, around 1800, or certainly eventually in Germany, which they were eventually. Jews can be part of everyone else. You're just a citizen of your country. That kind of changed the nature of Judaism. Before that, the Jewish people really were a people. If you were Jewish, well, I'll take, give you an example. The Rush, Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel, in the late 1290s, fled pogroms in Germany. Pogroms are not a new thing. They had pogroms, Rheinfleisch massacres. He and his family fled and went to Spain. Now, he did not speak Spanish. He would not have passed the modern Spanish test to become a citizen of Spain. And yet, when he moved to Spain, he was welcomed by the Rashba. There was a letter, in fact, declaring him to be the new person, become the posek in Spain. And I was curious, like, what did he do? We know the Rush wrote hundreds upon hundreds of tshuvot, besides his commentaries. Hundreds of tshuvot in the beginning of the 1300s in Spain. But what was he to communicate with everybody in? The Rush himself probably spoke some proto-Yiddish in his vernacular, right? And his academic language was obviously rabbinic, Hebrew, and Aramaic. So I don't know what he spoke to people in. Did people come and ask him questions in Aramaic? I mean, what did they do? They spoke to him in some sort of Hebrew, right? The communities there were speaking proto-Ladino and some version of Spanish. So it's very interesting. But they still welcomed him as his major posek. The same thing is going to go through the history of Judaism. I hear these professors now, they're these academics, and they're trying to say, oh, nationalism is a modern invention. Jews saw themselves as a nation as a modern invention. I hear that they're saying that. I challenge one of them. That seems to go against everything it says, both the experience of the rabbis of the Mishnaic period, the rabbis as they testify in the Talmud period, when they're going back and forth from Europe communities. It goes against what the rabbis and people of the Gaonic period, when they were writing letters back and forth to each other and traveled and met with each other. We know the Ramban went and met the Baalei Tosafot community who were living in Eretz Yisrael, who moved from Franco-Germany to Eretz Yisrael in the beginning of the 13th century, and the Ramban at the end of the 13th century met their children. They met the Rambam's kids. So it's just the fact of life. It seems to be almost like, you know, arguing against a wall, that Jews didn't have some sort of commonality of feeling they were all one people. You read the Siddur. It's not, we didn't invent the Siddur in the 19th or 20th centuries with nationalism. It talks about going back to Eretz Yisrael. It talks about Kibbutz Galiot. It talks about Jews as a people. These things are not invented. I find it bizarre that there are professors who are doing this. It's pretty much just an anti-Zionist polemic that's infiltrating academia. Anyone know what I'm talking about? I'm going to talk to myself, because I'm very upset about this. I find it absurd and obscene what these Jewish professors are trying to do. It totally goes against just facts. It's like arguing against the sky's blue. You open up the Siddur, the same Siddur people are praying in 1400 in Speyer or whatever, and it's the same more or less Siddur, and they're saying the same text. And say they didn't think about Eretz Yisrael seems like bizarre to me. Okay, going back to our topic though, comes along the Europe, and Europe starts to say, well, maybe Jews are not the demons that we have believed them to be. Many German Christians over time had developed this idea that Jews were a demon spawn. They were children of Cain. They walked around with the symbol of Cain. But then all of a sudden, Jews wanted to convert into part of regular society, part of the larger society. And large societies kind of things were breaking down. And when that happened, there were discussions, can Jews be like us? If people, if you take a course in anti-Semitism, often academics in anti-Semitism will split anti-Semitism into two epochs. They'll discuss anti-Judaism, which they claim is what the Christians and the Muslims had. We don't like the Jews because of their religion. If they convert to Christianity, we're all happy with them. Versus anti-Semitism, which is a modern invention, of which the most famous like progenitor of that is Voltaire, who said, no, Jews are intrinsically, biologically different than the rest of society, and therefore they have to be rejected. Obviously, when the Nazis come along 200 years later, you know where the underpinnings of that ideology are, right, from a biological standpoint. But at this time, the time I'm talking about now, early 1800s, Jews were struggling in Europe to define themselves as part of general society, at least in Central Europe. Okay, so far so good? We're good? Fine. So I think I mentioned last time that a lot of Jews were dumping Judaism, and some people came up, especially in Germany, and said, we don't want them to, we don't want people just to jump out of Judaism. Let's make Judaism, let's find the kernel, let's find the pristine aspect of Judaism, which is meaningful, and we know it's wonderful. We know that God gave it to Moses. We know that the prophets prophesied ethical monotheism. Let's spread this as an ideology, and we can attract Jews to stay within the fold. In as early as 1810, the first Reformed synagogue opened up in Germany. I'll just read you a little bit about that. The first Reformed temple opened its doors in the town of Seesum, Germany. The inaugural ceremony, now Jews were not citizens of Germany at the time. The inaugural ceremony on July 17th, 1810, a parade of rabbis, Christian ministers, and political dignitaries passed under a chiming bell tower, right? A bell tower. When you think of bell tower, what do you think about? A church, right? And into the sanctuary while an adult choir, when you think about a choir, like Germans eventually adapted it, but it was a church, accompanied by a pipe organ, what does it sound like? Church, sang hymns in German and Hebrew. So if you were a passerby hearing bells and then someone with an organ singing hymns in German, what would you probably think you're passing by? It's 1810. You'd probably think you're passing by a German Lutheran church. Now, you might have heard the Hebrew and been a little surprised by that. This morning on the way to Yeshiva, I was listening to a lecture by Cardinal, whatever, it goes on long, Cardinal Dolan of New York. It's really funny, he was pronouncing Hebrew. Those Catholics still can't learn. He couldn't pronounce Hebrew for his life. You think, like, you know, they might invest a little bit in language. Okay, he sounds kind of like a guy you'd want to go to a pub with. Not necessarily like a minister, but anyway, he's pretty funny. Guy. Fine. Now that was July 17th, 1810. July 17th, 1810 was a Tuesday. It was not Shabbat. Why was it not Shabbat? You can't have organ music on Shabbat. Right? You can't have organ. What?
Wasn't there at one point where
you eventually, yeah. Sunday? It's coming up. Well, there were some people who moved to Sunday. I don't know how dominant that was. There were some people who moved to Sunday. The drasha was given by a person who ran a school. One of the radical things he did was he was dressed just like Christian clergy in a robe. Standing behind a pulpit at the front of the sanctuary, the man who had also established the egalitarian, religiously pluralistic boarding school for 40 Jewish children and 20 Christian children, told the August Assembly, quote, "On all sides, enlightenment opens up new areas for religious development. Why should we Jews be left behind?" That kind of is symbolic. Why should the Jews be left behind the rest of the progress of Western culture? Right now, see, people don't care about non-Western culture because, like, we just invaded them and stole all their stuff, right? So that was okay. Britain was still, like, you know, stealing everything. And you guys been to the British Museum, right? It's the best. It's like, it's really like going to a thief's den, right? You know, and seeing everything the British Empire stole over the centuries. I like it. Like, you know, I think it's fun to go see, like, those things. But there, I would not get a chance to go to Iraq otherwise. Okay. So that's 1810 in Germany, and partially not only did they start changing the nature of the prayer service to make it more Christian seeming and inviting Christian clergy to join with them, they also started pushing the theological envelope and questioning on whether or not kashrut should count, what are the main pillars of Judaism, etc. Maybe we can find those things which we seem very similar to Christians, but are Jewish and maintain Jews still being Jewish, we can be normal just like you can. There's a famous joke that people like to say, the difference between Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, is a Reformer lazy, Conservative hazy, and Orthodox are crazy. It's one of those popular rabbi jokes, right? Offends everybody, so therefore, it used to be, you can't do that anymore, you can't offend anyone anymore, right? You know. But once upon a time, you were allowed to offend people like 3 years ago. So you could tell that joke in a synagogue, and no matter what synagogue it was, everyone laughed. Now they would like protest and do stuff like that. Okay. In any event, I want to talk about the obviously development of German Reform Judaism is going to go on a pace for a while until everything is snuffed out by the first, or just, you know, around 1935. And eventually we know that the German Jews who don't get out are all going to die. Or most of them are going to die. So, you know, we know this is going to happen. It's always weird talking about these things. We know, like, you know the end of the movie and it's going to be bad, right? It's going to be a Shakespearean tragedy. In any event, going back to Germany and in the early mid-19th century, there was this process of creating this new type of religious system, kind of walking away from what people had been doing. Obviously, there are people who pushed back. The people pushed back got labeled by the reformists as Orthodox. And that's how the term Orthodoxy got coined. It was actually a reform term to define people who were looking at tradition. At the same time, the beginning of the 19th century, or the first half of the 19th century, there were reform thinkers who were coming up and creating a theological approach to Judaism, which broke off from tradition, and wanted to look at Judaism through the lens. Remember, Germany at this time was the seat of Enlightenment. It was part of the Enlightenment project to kind of look at everything scientifically, dispel mythology. Way back when, in the 18th century, that was what Voltaire's job was. Voltaire hated Judaism because he hated Christianity. It was partially like a one fell swoop. He could knock out both things he hated and move on to the Enlightenment period where you don't believe in God and things like that. But the 19th century in Germany, so these German thinkers, the most famous of which is this guy, Abraham Geiger, were coming up with ideas of creating a new type of Judaism which would be in touch, in tune with the age. The same time in Europe, there were other people who kind of appreciated what some of the reformists were doing, but they themselves were traditionalist theologically, right? They didn't want to necessarily reject aspects of the mitzvot. They were traditional in their performance of mitzvot, but they were open to the new movements of scientific analysis of texts and things like that. The most famous of which is this guy, Zacharia Frankel. Zacharia Frankel lived almost the exact time as Abraham Geiger, mid-19th century. He started a seminary. And was kind of, by many people, considered one of the lights of this thing called the Wissenschaft des Judentums, the scientific analysis of Judaism. And their goal was to be traditionalists. You kept the mitzvot, fidelity to Torah, unlike the reformists. But on the other hand, you want to look at Judaism through the new lens of academic scholarship. Bring traditional Judaism up to date. Right, we talked about before that at the same time, and actually a friend of Abraham Geiger was of Senator Raphael Hirsch. Hirsch rejected the reform harshly, as you know. In fact, caused an entire split in German Judaism over it and said, we're not like them. So these are kind of three figures you can look at in Western European Judaism are all trying to come up with new ways to relate to Judaism such that it will be palatable to modernity. all in a certain sense kind of floating off of Moses Mendelssohn. So you have Geiger and the reformists saying we have to reject as much as we can. Samuel Hirsch saying, no, you have to maintain fidelity to everything, but it could be that we could change our clothes. In fact, he himself wore clerical robes. And you have people that were kind of finding a middle ground, Zacharia Frankel, saying, I like the academic stuff, I don't like the attack on tradition. Okay? That's kind of a picture of Germany. Jews in the United States of America, and at post-Holocaust, it really will be Israel and America. In fact, for a while, it'll be America. The devastation of Jews across Europe. And even in the Edot HaMizrach lands, they're a much smaller percentage. Pre-Holocaust, I saw one statistic want to claim that Jews from Iraq, Iran, etc., only represented about 7-10% of world Jewry pre-Holocaust. Today in Israel, as I mentioned, they're about 50% of the Israeli population, which makes them, across the globe, they're about 35% of Jewish population and rapidly growing. So just that tradition I'm going to leave a little bit on the side, and we can talk about it. We're going to talk about some Spanish versions in a minute when we get to America. Jews came to America, we know, before many Jews came to South America as part of the Spanish exploration. Partially because if you're fleeing Spain, you wanted to go to a place where maybe you understood what was going on, like Holland or South America, where the conquistadors had already kind of laid the groundwork and companies were going in there, and eventually to America. The first Jews in America were descendants of Spanish refugees. Right? They came to America in the South, the United States South, where I'm from. So a number of Spanish refugees eventually moved there and started Jewish communities there. By mid-19th century, a lot of German Jews... Yes? Yeah, you with me?
Yeah.
Yeah? This is like a historical overview, then we're going to theology. Okay, modern theology. Okay? Jews in Germany started moving. Jews of Central Europe started moving to the United States of America in mid-19th century. Okay? England had re-let Jews in already by 150, 200 years by now. Jews started living in England. I'll throw that in as a tidbit. I don't know anything about Australia. Eventually, some Jews would get out to Australia in prison colonies. I don't know. Whatever that is. But the influx, Jews started coming in. I forgot it was like in 18, something like 1840, there were like 15,000 Jews, or 1820 something, or 15,000 Jews. By the end of the century, there's going to be a million. Okay? Jews are flowing in to the United States. And with that, they were spreading out throughout the United States. How did people do that? If you came to the United States, let's say you came in 1825, the United States from Germany, and you had very little with you, right? You had nothing. 1830, whatever, 30-some-odd years before the Civil War. So you had very little, right? We know a little bit there's been a massive gold rush of people moving out west. As it is, Americans are moving westward. So a lot of immigrants came in with nothing, and therefore when you have nothing, you learn how to sell nothing. So a lot of Jews started picking up nothing. It could be they started picking up rags and selling rags. It could be they started peddling stuff. There was one record, I forgot, this is a great book, by the way. I think he mentions this number. Let's see if he mentions the number of peddlers. Talk about the peddlers here. I wonder if my place mark got moved by my children when they were cleaning up the house last night. In any event, peddlers, there was some claim that there were like 16,000 peddlers in the United States of America, meaning people who are putting packs on their back and going further westward to sell stuff. 16,000 peddlers or so by 1850. And there was a claim that by some records, maybe 90% of them were Jews. Okay, Jews were trying to make money like everybody else and moving westward by selling stuff on their back. You come in, you pick some stuff up, you'd sell it, buy a pack. Okay, pack, go a little further westward to Philadelphia or whatever, maybe Pittsburgh. In Pittsburgh, you made enough money, it's a very lucrative business, you could buy a cart, a horse and buggy. You do the horse and buggy, you move further west. Eventually, these people went out westward and set up stores. And that became like the famous, many of the famous major store owners were Jews by this development of going westward. When you went out west, kosher food was going to be more complicated. Setting up a Jewish community was more complicated. Meeting Jewish women was more complicated, right? So while people did set up synagogues in the mid-19th century, the synagogues that they set up, you know, most of them were going to be traditionalist because that's what people came from. Reform hadn't made such a gigantic inroad, but they were starting to lose a lot of their connection. By mid-19th century, rabbis came over from Germany and started taking over some of these synagogues. It's interesting, by 1900 or late 1890s, when there was an influx of Eastern European Jews, a lot of synagogues took votes on what they wanted to be. Like, they would invite a rabbi one week who was a reformist, and the next week an Orthodox traditionalist, and the next week something else, and then the synagogue would vote, what do we want to be? Right, because there was a lot of like confusion on Judaism coming to the United States of America. By the last quarter of the 19th century, Reform Judaism started to a large degree take over. And I want you to open up. No, not here. On this packet, I want you to look up. Open up, skip the timeline. We talk about some Reform synagogues opening. I want you to open up the picture platform 1885. Yeah, you see that? This is really the mark of the coming of age of Reform Judaism in America. In a certain sense, it's really the coming of age of Reform Judaism globally. In 1883, there was the first graduating class of the newly minted rabbinical school that was creating rabbis for the modern period, for modern America. And 2 years later, the people of that organization, so they started creating a rabbinical organization. We have synagogues that are going the reformist way. They're putting in, they're getting rid of separation and having people mixed together. They're starting to get rid of part of the davening. They're maybe changing the siddur to a larger extent. And by 1885, the rabbis decide to get together and have a convention in Pittsburgh. It's interesting, right, how west it was. Pittsburgh, relatively speaking, for the East Coast, is pretty west. It's not Chicago, and it's certainly not, you know, L.A. But it's pretty western for the Jewish community. This is before the massive. It's right at the beginning of the massive influx of Eastern European Jews starting in 1881. Okay, so in 1885, these rabbis get together and write this Pittsburgh platform. Could some people? I want you to read a couple snippets of it. Okay. So there's a bunch of rabbis who create an organization. We're the new reform in America. Okay? That's who we are. We're the new reform in America. We're the new reform globally. But we're going to set out, what does it mean to be a reform Jew? Okay? So a new thing. The rabbi with a lot of power who created this organization is Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss. Again, he was an immigrant also, as most of them were immigrants. He was an immigrant. A very smart Eloi type as a young age, and came to America and really decided that Judaism had to change. Could someone want to read? We'll read a few of these little paragraphs, giving you a snippet of what Reform Judaism looked like in 1885. Yeah, bakasha.
Starting from
as I always say, with drama, loudly, clearly, with drama.
Just start from the beginning.
Let's just go to number one. We recognize.
We recognize in every religion an attempt to grasp the infinite, and in every mode, source, or book of revelation held sacred in any religious system, the consciousness of the indwelling of God in man. We hold that Judaism presents the highest conception of the
God idea
as taught in our holy scriptures, and developed and spiritualized by the Jewish teachers, in accordance with the moral and philosophical progress of their respective ages. We maintain that Judaism preserved and defended amidst continual struggles and trials, and under enforced isolation. The God idea is the central religious truth for the human race.
Okay. First of all, the first line is of great significance. What's in the first line? What do they say?
All religions.
All religions are of great significance. Okay? We hold Judaism is like the head among equals. Right? And that God is a great thing. So when we read number two, we recognize the Bible? Yeah, Lakasha.
We recognize in the Bible the record of the consecration of the Jewish people to its mission as the priest of the one God and value it as the most potent instrument of religious and moral instruction. We hold that the modern discoveries of scientific researches in the domain of nature and history are not antagonistic to the doctrines of Judaism, the Bible, reflecting the primitive idea of its own age, and at times clothing its conception of divine providence and justice, dealing with men in miraculous narratives.
What would they say, number two?
Accepting science?
They say more than accepting science. They're not like talking about whether or not you should vaccinate your kids. Yeah.
Saying the Bible reflects its own age, but it's also compatible with science.
Is there a strong word? There's a strong word that jumps out at me. What do they call the Bible?
Primitive.
Primitive. Mm-hmm. Right? The Bible has some reflection of God, but it's a primitive work which reflects its own age. Look at number three in regards to mitzvot. Yeah. It's one or three?
You have to share.
You have to share, Rema. Want to read number three? Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
We recognize in the Mosaic legislation a system of training Jewish people for its mission during its national life in Palestine, and today we accept as binding only its moral laws and maintain only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, but reject all such as are not adopted to the views and habits of modern civilization.
Can you want to explain number three real quickly?
We're going to hold modern moral laws over our primitive historic ones.
Okay, read number four too, because they go together.
Okay, we hold that all such Mosaic and rabbinical laws as regulate diet, priestly purity, and dress originate in ages and under the influence of ideas entirely foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. They fail to impress the modern Jew with a spirit of priestly holiness. Their observance in our days is apt rather to obstruct than to further modern spiritual.
I love this one. What did they say in number four? Yeah? Anyone?
Basically that like our halakhas are meant for the old age.
And therefore
age.
Today what they do, yeah?
It's a good thing we don't keep kosher.
Because what do they do?
Actually, we're trying to be more holy, but we don't keep kosher.
They prevent us from being religious. They don't help us to fulfill Judaism. They prevent us from fulfilling Judaism. Right? Keeping mitzvot is a bad thing. Right? And we're going to stop with number five. But we'll culminate these in a second. Number five. Someone read number five? Yeah, Bakasha.
We recognize the modern era of universal cultural heart and intellect in approaching the realization of Israel as a great messianic hope for the establishment of the kingdom of truth, justice, and peace among all men. We consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine, nor sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any of the laws concerning the Jewish state.
In other words, Reform Movement 1885, what was their attitude towards Zionism, the nascent Zionist movement? Against it. We don't want that. In fact, Reform synagogues, to a large degree, are going to be called temples. Why were they called temples? It's not only them, but a large degree. What? The temple is where we are. Right? We don't want a temple in Jerusalem. The temple is where we are. We have no connection to what's going on in Palestine. Nothing. Right? We are citizens of our country, and we want to do all the modern things as citizens of our country. Yeah?
My great-grandmother was from Chile. She did not like saying the Shana of Yerushalayim and Pesach. She would say, I'm an American Jew, not an Israeli.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, if you were going to surmise, you can look, skim through them on the rest of yours. We don't believe in hell, heaven or hell, etc. If you were going to like surmise what this is, we want to do things which are modern. We're going to reject anything which is not modern. We have no desire to go back to Palestine, but we do want to keep ethics. We want to keep morals, right? That's what we think is the crux of Judaism. Is there kind of a vision, now placing this 1885 United States of America, right, 20 years after the Civil War, how would you define this document? What are they describing? If I took all Reform Jews in the top, what do you think I would be describing? What does it feel you feel like it's describing? Anything?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Okay, what?
Protestantism.
I would say I would put a hyphen before the word Protestantism and I'd add another word.
Judeo-Protestantism?
No.
American.
Right? American. Right? We have a platform, and the platform sets forth that we want to be American. What American means to be modern, it means to be part of the world. We're going to reject anything which, if anything, holds us back from spiritual fulfillment, which are keeping mitzvot. Right? And certainly we don't want any connection to Holy Land. Okay, we'll leave this. I want to skip ahead, and I'm going to talk about how this happened, but let's skip ahead a little bit to the 1999 document. Okay, we're going to skip 1937 and go 1999. I want you, before you read it, I want you to scan it with your eyes and tell me what's the difference in form between the document of 1999 and the Pittsburgh Platform of 1885. Okay, 100 years have passed, a little over 100 years have passed. Tell me what's the difference between the two documents. Form-wise, scan with your eyes. Something should jump out at you. Yes.
Hebrew words?
Hebrew! If you notice, 1885 did not use a single Hebrew word. Right? By 1999, not only did they use Hebrew words, but they wrote them in
Hebrew.
And in fact, if you take this document and get it offline, I got this from the Reform Movement, those are pictures, because I don't know, whoever typeset it didn't use proper, like, you know, whatever, proper Unicode or whatever it is, and therefore those are like pictures, are really hard to get. You have to get exactly the way it is on there. But now let's look through real quickly. They give a preamble talking about why they went through documents and the history of them, 1885, 1937. There was one in the 70s as well. They got to this one. Let's look at the kind of like the overarching structure. Okay, the overarching structure is broken into bold words. What are those bold words? God, Torah, and Israel. Okay? You don't even need much information. We go through God. We affirm the reality and oneness of God. Even as we may differ in our understanding of the divine presence, we affirm the Jewish people is bound to God by an eternal brit, as reflected in our varied understandings of creation, revelation, and redemption. We affirm every human being is created by Tzelem Elohim. We regard that the reverence of all God's creations recognizes our human responsibility for its preservation and protection. We encounter God's presence in moments of awe and wonder, in acts of justice and compassion, in loving relationships. We respond to God daily through public and private prayer, and through study, and through performance of mitzvot, and being out of the sacred ones, being out of the makom, being out of the chavero. What does this sound like? Yeah.
Turn back towards tradition.
Yeah. Now, also, listen to the tone, the tonality. There's a tone difference. Look at the tone. This is what I'm going to suggest. Look at the tone difference of 1885 to the tone of this. Yeah.
Well, the 1999 one is more like this kind of bold statements, like, you know, in all these ways and words, like, blank is more purpose and meaning to our lives.
Okay.
So it ends on like a very religious note. It's Look at definitely a more religious tone. The other one reads more like a, like some kind of, like, I don't know, like a manual, some sort of memo or something.
So if you were going to go to the 1885 document, what are they trying to do? Yeah.
I thought, like, I don't know about tone-wise, but content-wise,
yeah,
the 1885 document is much more accusatory. And this one's much more apologetic.
1885, they're rejecting. We are rejecting something. We are rejecting traditional Judaism. In 1999, we're embracing it. It's a very interesting change. Over 100 plus years in time, right, the Reform Movement went on like an arc. The American Reform Movement went on an arc where they rejected a lot, right, and it was seemingly based on rejection of things, to create an Americana, which is not like the European experience of the medieval Jew, all the way to the 20th century, the 21st century, where it's much more like embracing. Now, let's go to 1937 for a second. I'm jumping around, but I wanted to give you the panorama view. Now, I want to look at 1937, which is the Columbus platform. Look at 1937 and tell me, you know, glance it over real fast, okay? We'll spend 2 minutes reading it, all right? And I want to talk about that. You don't have it here. Choose one. Anything jump out at you?
Like Israel again?
What about Israel?
I like it again.
All of a sudden, this 1937, the State of Israel was founded when?
1948.
As well as, remember, 1937, what's happening in the world in 1937?
Beginning.
Well, I wouldn't even say the Holocaust yet. right? But you're right. That's the direction. Germany has gotten really nasty, right? The German Jewish experience is really nasty, right? It's getting worse. And we all know what's going to happen, right? It's going to be worse in a certain sense in Poland, right, when they invade. But we know what's going to happen, right? But they don't necessarily know that for sure, right? They know a lot of anti-Semitism. We know that the Germans, you know, Hitler has risen to power, and he said a lot of bad things, and there were some bad events that happened. But the idea of the real Holocaust, the heart of the Holocaust, we think of Auschwitz, hasn't happened yet, right? It's not even, it's unimaginable, right? You put yourself in that. We all live post that, and we know that they sent our ancestors to death camps and crematoria. We know that, right? They don't know that, right? Yeah.
Nationalism,
to get back to that, nationalism, they're pro-Zionists. They might not want to move to Israel, but they're pro-Zionism, right? It's also a beginning of being a little more conciliatory. And the language, God, man, Torah, Israel, it's already beginning of that arc. You can see the arc is starting to turn, right? They rejected, and now they say, whoa, they rejected too much. Okay, that's the in a nutshell, kind of the arc, the trajectory of reform movement. Now, a few things I need to throw in there. The reform movement is kind of in America, went through this, we want to be 100% American, we want to get rid of things like don't wear a kippah, and don't wear a tallit, and in some synagogues they prohibited that, in fact. You were not allowed to wear them. I heard a reform rabbi speak that when he took over the synagogue in like 1983, how he was the first rabbi to wear a tallit and a kippah on the bima, and how he had to ask when they hired him. They offered him the job, and he agreed to the job on the condition he could wear a kippah and a tallit. Now, it's interesting because he was a graduate of the Reform Rabbinical Schools, and he was already in that trajectory of becoming more traditionalist. And he went to the board and said, listen, if you'll accept that I'm going to wear a kippah on the bima, then I can take the position of being your rabbi. If you don't, I won't. And the board debated that. This is one of the biggest Reform synagogues in Manhattan. They debated, and they agreed to allow him to wear a kippah. Right, so it's very interesting. Now all the rabbis wear tallits and kippot and stuff. The men, the women, whatever. At that time, they didn't have women rabbis yet, really. But that. On the other hand, one thing the Reform Movement did in 1983, the Reform Movement in America allowed pastoral dissent, despite the fact that many people, including Orthodox thinkers, begged them not to. What's pastoral dissent? Generally speaking, this person is Jewish if their mother is Jewish. However, the Reform Movement in 83, declared that they were going to accept if either parent is Jewish, then the child of the offspring of that marriage will be considered Jewish if they so deem to be. And they also their attitude towards conversion, etc., became much less. Remember, before this, that wasn't the case, right? Before this, a Jewish marriage between a Jew and a Jew. And the offspring, if they were not of two Jews, were not Jewish in the Reform Movement. So the Reform Movement, in a certain sense, has become much more like they're open to Hebrew, and they say a lot of Hebrew. If you watch the Reform Convention, they have a lot of, I was shocked, the amount of Hebrew music. They just play tons and tons of Hebrew music. It's much more traditionalist feeling. On the other hand, in regards to real legal things, they push the envelope in a far direction. For years, the Reform Movement in America did not allow rabbinical students to be married or dating a non-Jew. Okay? Recently, there was a whole tumult over that where a Reform rabbinical student wrote a thing that was about 4 years ago saying, this is discriminatory policy. Furthermore, if you look at the prophet Isaiah, and he's quoting Isaiah and whatever, who better, when we realize that American Jews are intermarrying, and it's true in England, it's a little bit less, but not much less in other countries, it's true that the majority of marriages between a Jew and another person are with a non-Jew. Okay? The majority of marriages between a Jewish person and another person are non-Jew. So that means the majority of marriages today of people under the age of 50 or so, if they're married, is between a Jew and a non-Jew. If that's the case, who better to serve a community with intermarried than an intermarried rabbi? Right? So therefore, it's, of course, what Judaism should do. We actually should have intermarried rabbis. Because, real quickly.
And
reminds me of the story about the issue with the French revolutionary saw his people run, so he said, I must run with them so I can leave them.
Okay. It reminds me of Ernie Nachman's story about the guy who's a chicken. Right? But we'll leave that. We could talk about that. But that's the approach. That's kind of the view of the. I don't have, like, you know, obviously we could spend. I used to give a chug in this for a whole year, but we could spend a long time discussing development reform. But that's kind of an overarching picture. Reform movement, on the one hand, jesting a lot of stuff. On the other hand, they're just creeping towards tradition. On the other hand, a legal position going away. It's a little hard to understand. If you looked at a Reform temple in 1975, 1970, no one wore talluses, whatever. If you go now, they will. On the other hand, the odds on them being not Jewish, 100%. Well, there's a tshuva by the Reform movement from the 80s, the early 80s, I think. And they're all online, their tshuvot, on whether or not a person who is a practicing Catholic can be the head of the woman, can be an officer of the synagogue. Right? So they're practicing Catholic, they're going to be an officer in the synagogue, and a Reform movement decided they definitely could not be president of the synagogue, etc. And said they really shouldn't be president of any of the organizations of the Reform temple. But, you know, it's like a funny thing. Yeah?
I'm trying to get to this, but why did the shift actually happen?
It's a good question. Less of the conservative movement, and then I'll make up stuff. Okay, I will totally make up stuff. Let's go back to Europe. Zacharia Frankel, late 19th century. In Europe, there was a bit of a rejection against these reformists and trying to create something that, again, was a hybrid, more open towards the academic tools that were becoming popular in universities. On the other hand, fidelity to tradition. In 1883, as I mentioned before, there was the first graduating class of the new Reform rabbinical school in America. At that event, they invited, this was in Cincinnati, Ohio, they invited all these rabbis who were connected to the Reform movement to come and celebrate with them. Now, the Reform movement in America in the 1880s, in the 1880s, you have to look, understand, 1880s America, the vast majority of Jews were of German descent, and a lot of Eastern Europeans were flowing in. Of those, some rabbis who came over from the old world were very traditionalists, what we would call, you know, totally Orthodox today. Some of those were more reformists, right? But the lines were a little porous on who was who and trying to figure out who was going to take over what, which synagogues were going to be what. And some people who were very traditionalists were very into this united organization of synagogues and creating a rabbinical school. One of them was Sebeda Marias, who we're going to come back to in a minute. Rabbi Sebeda Marias, who himself was Sephardi, a brilliant guy. A number of them went to this Reform graduation ceremony. Now, the Reform graduation ceremony, Isaac Meir Weiss, who at the time still believed supposedly in keeping kosher, Isaac Meir Weiss promised everyone that the event will be 100% according to Jewish dietary laws. Here is the menu from the graduating ceremony, 1883, of the rabbinical school, the first group of rabbis. Would anyone like to read it? It's a little bit, you know, and if you can find anything non-kosher on this menu, I dare you. Okay. Now, if you were going to create a non-kosher event, right, to demonstrate you don't keep kosher, what would it look like?
This.
It would look like this, right now. Isaac Meir Weiss, at the event, a number of rabbis came, traditionalists who kept kosher. And what do you think they did when they showed up to this hotel?
They
freaked out. Right, so Isaac Meir Weiss got up and said, no, the caterer just did, he was supposed to have a kosher event, he just doesn't really understand kosher catering exactly. This was not meant to offend, right? But if you're a traditionalist rabbi, you might find that hard to believe, right? So in 1883, a number of rabbis were gagged and aghast at this, If you want online, there's a lecture someone gave recently in California, in San Francisco or something, trying to claim this was not the great watershed event that everyone claims it is. But it's popularly known as the watershed event. This is well known. This is known in the annals of American Jewish history as the Treifa Banquet. Right? This was kind of the declaration of war, as it was, on traditional Judaism. That's how many people saw it. And post this, Isaac Meir Weiss got up and said, those crazy Orthodox, they believe in kitchen Judaism as opposed to what really is important, ethical monotheism. Right? And he then became an anti-keeping kosher. Remember, this is 1883. You can understand by 1885 what was in the minds of those Reform rabbis when they produced that document saying, we're not that. We're not like those crazies. A number of rabbis who left this said, we can't, this cannot be American Judaism. We have to come up with something which is traditionalist. And we're going to start our own rabbinical school. Ha! We'll start our own rabbinical school in 1886, the same year the Yeshiva University kind of started as a high school. It's going to go through metamorphosis. They started another rabbinical school. And one of the people who had been involved in the Reform movement, Rabbi Sebeda Marias, who was the rabbi of a synagogue called Mikvah Yisrael, one of the earliest synagogues in Philadelphia, he was going to be the first rector of this new synagogue. Now, he himself was Italian Sephardic Rav, and this is how he describes it. This is a wonderful book, by the way, if you want a nice reader on modern Orthodoxy. But again, we're talking about 1886 now, influx of Eastern European Jews. The numbers of American Jews are skyrocketing. Europe's starting to post a number of pogroms and whatnot. Europe is starting to slowly, and then obviously Nazis are going to speed it up, slowly lose their Jews to America. You know, Israel was very... This is not a Zionist discussion. As you know, in Israel, was very few people going there, the first Aliyah wave at this point in time. So this is what Sebeda Marias says about this new seminary. With all my heart, I had hoped that in no time I should feel morally bound to notice aspersions against an institution. Okay, he's complaining about it. People are attacking this crazy new institution. The Jewish Theological Seminary cannot lay claim to universal applause for its achievements, etc. And the title of this, I don't have like a little good spot here, is he wanted to call it the Orthodox Seminary of America. When he founded the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, he considered it to be 100% the new world of Orthodoxy. This will be American Orthodoxy. They're going to invite scholars, some of whom were taught in Europe in the Vision Shop School, which was controversial. People like Hirsch did not like them. And they're going to come to the seminary, and some of them will be very traditionalist, some of them will be very less traditionalist, but this will be the new American Orthodoxy. By the beginning of the 20th century, the lines between Orthodoxy and non-Orthodoxy, once you rejected the Reform, were not so clear. There are some people who accused the new seminary of being not Orthodox. They brought in a scholar named Solomon Schechter and another scholar, Louis Ginsberg. Great Talmudist, Louis Ginsberg. Louis Ginsberg was accused of saying that biblical criticism was okay. So was Schechter. But Schechter accused Stanislav Hirsch of being considered the right-wing Orthodox, where he considered himself to be like mainstream Orthodox. In fact, the Orthodox Union, you guys know the OU, was founded originally as a fundraising branch for the Jewish Theological Seminary. The idea at the beginning of the 20th century was this is going to be like modern Orthodoxy, the view of modern Orthodoxy. Okay, so that's kind of how they were. Now, it's easy for me to point to Reform and say the Reform, look, here's what they looked like in 1885, at least in theory. This is what they looked like in 1937, the 70s, the 90s. It's harder for me to put my finger on conservative Judaism. Now, at this time, beginning of the 20th century, they created this institution. There were some synagogues affiliated with them. Some had machitzot, some didn't have machitzot. Some considered themselves Orthodox, some considered themselves something else. What's important is that eventually the Jewish Theological Seminary will invite two different scholars. I use these as kind of like polls to kind of demonstrate the haziness, as it were, of how they define themselves. So two of the scholars who were invited to teach at the seminary, one who probably had more influence on rabbis than any other rabbi in America, was Mordechai Kaplan. Mordechai Kaplan was born in 1881, almost the same time that Hirsch passed away. 1881, and died in 1983, right, 102 years old. He was the founder of the New York Jewish Center. Okay, seemingly an Orthodox rabbi, lives in his tradition. But he is you know what he's known for as the founder of what? As the what?
He started the Young Israel
movement. Yeah, he started the Young Israel movement, and he's also known as the inventor of Reconstruction Judaism. By the 1930s, he was writing documents, and it's going to develop over time, a notion that we have to reject anything which is supernatural in Judaism. He distanced himself. He did not like the Reform because they rejected mitzvot. And what do they do? Like, they're totally rejecting everything. Rejected mitzvot, rejected peoplehood. He was an ardent Zionist. He himself didn't necessarily want to live. He lived in Israel for a while, but he did not necessarily want to live in the state. But he was a Zionist of the Echad HaAm style Zionist, where Israel should be, and he writes this, Israel should be the epicenter of all Jewish thought and Jewish religion. And it should be like, from there, everything will grow out. This he wrote before the state was created, when at the same time the Reform are changing their mind, so was Kaplan. On the other hand, Kaplan believed in a very naturalist understanding of religion, not believing that God is a traditional God that, you know, does anything with the power, but more as the experience of humanity. Okay? So you have Kaplan, who's advocating naturalism, right? Keep mitzvot, but you should believe there is no such thing as a God who created the world or something like that. 100% science, but you can believe that God is kind of like the collective humanity, the way collective humans work. It's almost something akin to a pantheistic view of theology, but extremely naturalistic. Okay? And he was at the Jewish Hasidic Seminary for decades, upon decades training rabbis. You have him on the one hand. On the other hand, you have people like Saul Lieberman. Saul Lieberman was a traditional Talmudist who learned in the Yeshiva Slobodka in Europe. He came to Israel and learned at Hebrew University. He eventually became the head of Machon Harry Fischel, which is an Orthodox institution in Israel. He went to America. Supposedly, Verhutner wanted to hire him to come to Chaim Berlin to teach. He didn't. He went to the Jewish Theological Seminary. But in his own deportment, he kind of collected around him a number of thinkers in the Talmud department who were all traditional Orthodox people. You saw him today, you would say, oh my gosh, that's 100% modern Orthodoxy to the end. Right? Very astute scholars, etc. So you have these two poles, kind of. You have the Kaplanist vision, which is naturalism and pantheism and this type of thing, or you call it something else, panentheism, whatever it is, some sort of naturalistic view of the world, but keep me told. And you have the Lieberman School and those people who are all in JTS. Now, why in the mid-20th century, this new movement, which had changed and became a conservative movement, you guys with me? Am I losing you? Some of you? We'll do some text then. I like to switch around so we can like not have it all just lectury. I have the wrong document. I want to look at Solomon Schefter. So this is Solomon Schefter. Some of you guys know, I'm not sure we read this. Let's read this text. Ashes of Rabbinic Theology by Solomon Schefter. He was in the beginning of the 20th century, he revamped the Jewish Theological Seminary and really made it what it is, set it on its course. So someone want to read for me? This is from his book. It's a wonderful book. I highly recommend this book. Beautiful English. He himself was Russian and then went to Cambridge. He's well known for his excavations in the Cairo Geniza. And he brought all these stuff, like the rest of the English did, stealing all the stuff from other places. Stole it from Egypt, brought it to Cambridge. Cambridge felt, well, it's the stolen goods anyway, take whatever you want. And he brought it to the Jewish Theological Center in America, made them to have probably the best, until Hebrew Jews developed their new system, certainly for most of the 20th century, the best Jewish manuscript collection in the world. So I want to read for me this. So this is the beginning of the 20th century, kind of like what is going to become American conservatism. Yeah, roll out. All right.
It must, however, be remarked that this satisfying the needs of anybody and everybody is not the highest aim which Judaism set before itself. Altogether, one might venture to express the opinion that the now fashionable test of determining the worth of a religion by its capability to supply the various demands of the great market of the believers has something low and mercenary about it. Nothing less than good old honest heathen pantheon would satisfy the crazes and cravings of our present pampered humanity. With its pagan reminiscences, and its metaphysical confusion of languages and theological idiosyncrasies. True religion is above these demands.
Okay, so what did Schachter just say? Yeah.
Judaism shouldn't be apologetics.
It should be apologetics. He says that. I think he says more than that, though, I think.
It shouldn't have to conform to all opinions.
Everything. We're not everything. Right? He's going to go on to say so much as white, beautiful. He quotes Avraham Avinu. Look at the last paragraph. Judaism means to convert the world, not to convert itself. It will not die in order not to live. It disdains a victory by defeating itself and giving up its essential doctrines and its most vital teaching. Who's he referring to?
Reformed Jews.
The Reform movement. You've given up everything. How can you do that? It has confidence in the world. It hopes, it prays, and waits patiently for the great day when the world will be ripe for its acceptance. Very non-apologetic. Exact sense. It's not apologetic. And in fact, we have specific doctrines. We have a belief system. Right? And you have to accept that belief. And if you don't, that's not Judaism. Okay? That is Solomon Schachter writing in the 20th century. Let's look at the end of the 20th century. Okay? This is an article of New York Times. It's very long. Let's skip the underlying section. Where he quotes Lawrence Schiffman. Does anyone know who Lawrence Schiffman is?
Isn't he the dean of
Torah? Is he now? He was at YU for a little bit. Lawrence Schiffman was a professor at NYU, one of the great experts in the late 20th century on Dead Sea Scrolls. One of the top research scientists in Dead Sea Scrolls, and 100% Orthodox Jew. Okay? 100% Orthodox Jew. Look what he said. This is referring to their new Chumash. A new Chumash was published, as you can see, this is like around 2001, called the Eitz Chaim. For years and years and years, most of the 20th century, conservative synagogues used the Chumash that was authored, put together by one of their first JTS graduates. The first JTS graduate, and that was Rabbi Hertz. Rabbi Hertz is also known as what? You know what Rabbi Hertz is also known for? Not just his Chumash, Chief Rabbi of England. Okay, he became the Chief Rabbi of England. Okay, and he put out a Chumash, the Hertz Chumash, which is used throughout the world. And it was used in most conservative synagogues until 2001 when they came out the Eitz Chaim Chumash. Okay? Anyone read the Hertz Chumash? You guys have seen it, no? It used to be like the thing. Like, you know, Orthodox synagogues, conservative synagogues in Jacksonville, and where I grew up, all the synagogues used it. Didn't matter which brand you were. Then the Reform Chumash came out, the Plough Chumash came out, they replaced the Hertz's with the Reform one, and the Conservative eventually, I guess, I haven't been there, but replaced it with Eitz Chaim, and the Orthodox one eventually replaced the Arch Scroll. But for 40 years, 50 years, it was the standard Chumash used in a variety of synagogues. And one of the things the Hertz Chumash sets out a polemic against, you know what it's polemic against? Biblical criticism. Right? If you open up from page one, throughout the Hertz Chumash, he has tirades against Wellhausen and the documentary hypothesis and the absurdity of it. Okay? Now, we're looking at this is our, we can read the article if you want on your leisure, but this is Schiffman referring to this new Chumash that came out in 2000, 2001. Mm-hmm. So you want to read it for me, the underlying section, Lawrence Schiffman? Right there, that page, New York Times article.
By the way, I'm just both Shipman's not in Henry Abramson's in Durham now.
Yeah, he's at YU, right?
Yeah.
He retired. YU was like a retirement home. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of professors who were professors a long time for somewhere, and they retired. Orthodox professors, but they were Penn or NYU or whatever. Apparently they retire and they go to their retirements at YU because they want to have like from students. It's very interesting.
Well, I'm sure my professor at New York University and Orthodox Jews said that Eitz Chaim goes so far accepting modern scholarship that without realizing it ends up being a nihilistic opposition to what conservative Jews stand for.
In other words, by by the year 2000, Solomon Schachter would not have recognized what the conservative movement was. He did not, no longer believe in tradition. Now, if you look if you look at Kaplan, that's not very surprising. If you look at someone like Lieberman, that was surprising. If you look at Schachter, it was surprising. If you skip, I want you to look real quickly. I have a survey. Where did I put that survey? The very back, there are a few passages here. Now, this again, we have an arc. It seems like the end of the 20th century, when conservative Jews in America started, it was very similar to Orthodox. It was Orthodox, right? As the 20th century progressed, it became less and less so. By mid-20th century, by the 50s and 60s, conservative Judaism shared the lion's share of Jews in America. If you ask someone on the street, what are you? They would say they're a conservative Jew. They had the largest synagogues. They had the largest funding, right? Certainly by the 70s and the 80s. Now they're going down. Just like the arc of theology, so to the arc of the actual percentage of affiliated Jews. The largest now in America is Reform. They have 1 million people or so. Conservatives have about 600,000 people who say they're conservative Jews, where in 1980, a million did. So 400,000 people stopped considering themselves, whatever that means, you know, death and war and blah, blah, blah. But it gives you a picture. This survey, I want to look at the Chubar Gontra Feinstein real fast, and then we'll look at the survey. Which is a couple lines in the Chuba. This is a Chuba on whether or not you're allowed to teach in a non-Orthodox, you're allowed to teach in a conservative school, Talmud Torah. Okay, so we want to venture to read the beginning of the Tshuva. Hinei B'Dvar Misra, okay? You want to read that?
I'll do it.
Bakasha.
B'Dvar Misra Shigavela Medetzal Kofrim Nehobetam.
Okay, so this is in regards to getting a salary, Shekibel Malak Foto. So he's referring to an Orthodox rabbi. An Orthodox rabbi wrote him and said, listen, I have a job in a conservative school after my job in the Orthodox school. I teach the Orthodox Talmud Torah in the morning, and in the afternoons I teach in a conservative school. And the people of the Orthodox school wanted to fire him over it. They told him, you either have to quit or we're going to fire you. Okay, you can't teach both the Orthodox school and at the conservative school. Yeah.
He's using Kofrim, like a synonymous with conservative?
Yeah, that's my point. Okay? So he's saying, in regards to your job with the heretics, the hell of a Talmud Torah is the Lord, you will have Doke Tanim. So I think it's permissible to teach there. Rav Mordechai is going to deal with that. I'm not belaboring the halakhic issue. I'm more interested in the philosophic issue. While it's okay for you to teach there, as long as you teach the truth. Okay? Okay, I'm not okay. Fine. You'll actually do the halakha with Rav Mordechai, but the point is your first term is heretics, and that is highly problematic for him. In response to this tshuva, one of the major rabbis of the conservative movement, Rabbi Joel Roth, in his book, in a footnote, attacks Rav Moshe Feinstein. So I want to read that local cross-linguistic analysis of Joel Roth. This came out in the 80s, and his response to Rav Moshe Feinstein. So Rav Moshe Feinstein refers to conservatives as heretics, and therefore you got to deal with them as heretics. Okay. You want to read Joel Roth? Yeah, bakasha.
I would surmise...
Real loud!
I would surmise, of course, Feinstein would point to the widespread denial of the Messianic authorship of the Torah by conservative Jews and their apparent lack of commitment to halacha as basis for the contention that they are heretics.
Okay, so Rabbi Roth says that he imagines Moshe Feinstein has two reasons to consider conservative Jews heretics. What are the two reasons?
Halacha and Torah and Sinai.
They don't live in Torah and Sinai, don't keep halacha. Right? Okay, so then he goes, I disagree. I say the two together because I expect a strong positive cause-effect relationship. You don't believe in halacha Moshe Sinai. You don't keep halacha. He says, oh, I disagree. We just treat halacha differently. Okay? I don't know if Rabbi Roth really meant that because most conservatives do not keep halacha. But he goes, oh, we just relate to halacha differently. We observe halacha, just not the halacha that he does. Okay, fine. In a survey,
In a survey of concerned Jews, I used to have the entire survey, but I lost it, and then I wrote to Rabbi, to Professor Cohen, and he never wrote it. He couldn't find the original documents, and now he's kind of not popular. But nonetheless, he was Stephen Cohen was the sociologist, like the top sociologist of Judaism in America until 2 years ago. He wrote he did this survey. Now, if you look in the survey, he's going to ask a series of questions. The survey is like 36 questions. We're only looking at a few of them here. The groups that are broken down, where you see percentages, first column, percent, second, third, fourth, see that?
Yeah.
The first column are rabbis, so conservative rabbis. So I want to skip down to the section where it says, do you agree or disagree with the following? The Torah was written, it's the fourth to the last question on the page. Last page, it's the fourth to the last question on the page. Do you want to see that? Yeah? The Torah was written by people and not by God or by divine inspiration. So the Torah was not even divinely inspired. Meaning this is against Heschel. If you know, Heschel was one of the other great philosophers at JTS. Even disagreement with Heschel. Do you agree or disagree? So 36% say they agree the Torah was not divinely inspired. These conservative rabbis, pulpit rabbis. And 53% say they disagree. Okay? Now, if you notice, 53 and 36 doesn't add up. So, if we take the disagree, just over half of conservative rabbis would say they disagree that the Torah wasn't written by God. Do you understand that? It's a double negative.
Or it is written by God.
What?
Or it is written by God.
So, yeah, but you have to see the way the question's asked. In sociological studies, it's always important. Okay? So if I said the Torah is not divine, right, only 53% would say that's not true, it is. Whatever divine means. Okay? So that, based on that, 47% are not prepared to say the Torah came from God in one way or the other. Okay? Now what does that mean? One is rabbis, one is cantors and professionals, one is lay leaders, and one is lay people. If I'm, okay? Fine. So, the denial of Mosaic authorship seems to be almost, you know, almost half of rabbis and synagogues don't believe the Torah has anything to do with God. Right? That seems to be pretty severe. I had a piece for you from the Reform Chumash, not from that one, but Reform Chumash. Oh, I printed it. I didn't take it off the printer. By Rabbi Plaut. I didn't take it off the printer. I'm sorry. But Rabbi Plaut, though. No. Beginning of his Chumash, this is Rabbi Plaut from the Reform Movement, writing in the 1980s, says, of course, we're not like fundamentalists who believe the Torah comes from God. We do not believe the Torah comes from God, in which case our commentary is based on the fact that Torah doesn't come from God. If that's so, then what does the Torah have to do with God? And then he proceeds to try and explain why he thinks a Jew might be invested in reading Torah. This is 1980 Reform Movement. It seems to me, this is my polemic, it seems to me, you see what's just happened? Now, I didn't get a chance to discuss like the influx of Eastern European Jews in the mid-20th century, post-Holocaust, and how that impacted the development of the conservative movement. That's a huge thing. There are some people who suggest that experience in the military, the United States military, where if you were an Army chaplain in World War II, Army chaplains had to kind of like relate to all types of Jews, right? So they had to relate to Jews who knew nothing to Orthodox Jews. If you're, you know, if you were at Normandy, you got to relate to everybody. What are you going to do? Right? If you're in Saipan, my father's in Saipan, you're a chaplain, you got to relate to everybody. Right? I still have my dad's stuff from the armed services, his mops and everything from the armed services. What do? So you got to create a service which is kind of in the middle, and then people came back and said, gee, this kind of middle road service, which is a little bit reformy, but it's not so reformy, it doesn't seem so church-like, it seems much more Jewish, has Hebrew, but has a lot of English, etc., is kind of in the middle, right? People sit together, but, you know, they still keep kosher. That kind of thing was very attractive in the 1950s, it seems. Something like in the middle there. The Ark, do you see what's happening? Right, the Reform Movement started out, we deny Israel, we deny Hebrew, we don't want anything special. And by the turn of the 20th century, 21st century, there is a coming back.
You can wear these things. You can wear a kippot, have bar mitzvahs, all this stuff. Almost like coming back to tradition. What do you see in the conservative movement? You see the original rejection of reform by Schechter seems to have lost its momentum. And indeed, I have something here I want to read to you. And then, by the way, here's an antiquated discussion by Professor Elliot Dorf from LA of different views of religion. But I want to read you something. Was just in, it's in a magazine called Aegis Philanthropy. It's hot off the press 2 weeks ago. The conservative movement does not, unlike the reform movement allows their rabbis to perform intermarriages. So you can do a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. That's okay. And of course the kids, no matter which side, as long as they're raised Jewish, will be Jewish. Okay? The conservative movement rejects patrilineal descent, only accepts matrilineal descent, and does not allow their rabbis to marry Jews and non-Jews. So here is something by a young rabbi, came out 2 weeks ago, which is kind of reflective of a trend. Okay, here's the trend. Everyone listening? Yeah? It's hard for me to read stuff to you, and it's a lot of information. I'm kind of giving you an overarching picture. And I'm going to go for 5 more minutes. Okay? Exactly 5 minutes. If you hold me for 5 minutes, I guarantee I'll be done by that time. Okay? My goal was to go an hour and 15, so it's pretty much going to be on the money. The ban on conservative rabbis officiating, participating in, and even attending wedding ceremonies between Jew and someone from another background has been in place. The ban is because this. I believe tribunal stance in marriage is wrong, and it's time for a change. My colleagues and I should be permitted to officiate at wedding ceremonies between a Jew and someone from another background, in instances where it can reasonably be presumed the Jewish part will remain Jewishly committed. We're insofar as religious practice in the household, if there is any religion, it will be Judaism, or any children produced in the union will be Jews. He goes on to say, I came to this conclusion based on my research in halacha. I believe this is true. He goes on to say, I believe my research in halacha and Jewish tradition has led me to this conclusion that indeed we should reform marriages between Jews and non-Jews. I don't even understand it as far as tradition goes, but what does give you a picture of the direction that they're going. Now, I want to, in the last 3 minutes, I want to say a slight caveat. Okay, what I've described here are the elites. This guy, the elite reform movement, their leadership. I described the elite conservative movement. I've suggested, I think, that what's happening is a coalescence of the two, whereas reform is making a step towards tradition to a large degree, at least in the outer way they're dressing, etc. Kippot, willing to do mitzvot, Hebrew. The conservative movement is going the other direction. I would suggest that they're going less and less committed to tradition, whether it be theological or mitzvot oriented, and proof of this, right? But again, this is the elite perspective. I'm not talking about the common person. People who self-define as conservative Jews, by and large right now, according to one conservative rabbi I saw, wanted to claim that there's only 25% intermarriage rate, where people who define themselves as Reform Jews, there's a 65% intermarriage rate. So intermarriage rate is much faster in Reform. Of Jews as a whole in America, it's a 70% intermarriage rate. Right, so taking into consideration a lot of people who are neither conservative reform but are just Jewish. So on the one hand, there's a lot of overlap, which is starting. But again, I'm talking about if you speak to a rabbi who is trained and can think about things. You meet a common person on the street, right, and you start asking about theological presuppositions or the history, they won't know what you're talking about. The average Jew, I'll tell you, I have a friend who's conservative, and says, Todd, you believe in X, Y, and Z, but I'm conservative, what do I believe? Right? And I think that is actually a good model. I think most people just don't think about it. They might go to a synagogue. To quote Neil Gilman, one of the other philosophers at JTS, who passed away 2 years ago, he said, he thinks the difference between a Reformed Jew and a conservative Jew is which synagogue they don't attend. Right? So by and large, the majority of conservative reform people do not attend synagogues. They don't know much about theology. They don't know about Jewish learning. etc. So what I've described as the elites, and how more people deal with the halakhic issues, how do you kind of deal with that? Because there's a huge difference between the person you come to on the street who doesn't know anything about anything versus an elitist person who spent 5 years in rabbinical school and now can discuss things very intelligently. They're very different. Okay, so you have to, I think, bifurcate that. There are a lot of reform and conservative trained rabbis who know a tremendous amount, are serious academics, very thoughtful, but whether or not that actually trickles down to the common person is a different question. So that's kind of an overview of the 20th century of conservative reform Judaism and an idea of at least areas to go. When you're dealing with 100 years of history and millions of people and literature, it's hard to boil it down into an hour and 15 minutes. Lecture, but I tried to at least give you a thumbnail sketch of 20th century Judaism, at least outside of Israel. I didn't deal with Israel or the other countries that it deals with. England, it's applicable to a little bit, at least the reform. Okay, that's it.
Okay, thank you, Robert. 4 minutes now, 10:40. We're going to pick up here in 10 minutes. Please take a 10-minute break. We're going to do like this. We're going to have normal Seder. Everyone should produce their chavruta. There's a page around.